Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Matthews.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Haggerty.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spring from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashin, and you're listening to Not the Swedish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and it's good to be back. And thank you everyone that was listening to the last podcast with Jamie Fuller about the governance of sport around the world. A lot of really positive feedback, and thank you for taking the time to comment. Really do appreciate it. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And we've got a slightly different show for you today because we've actually got two guests lined up. Normally we only have the one, so we're going to have the guests sandwiched by a little bit of a discussion, and then we'll probably have a little bit of a brief chat after the second interview because that's a little bit shorter. First up, we've got Anthony Farry, who's the coach of the Japanese women's hockey team. And then later in the show, we're going to have Sampuna Rath, who hails from Bhubaneswar, which is hosting the Hockey World Cup. And he's opening a really special museum there. And I think anyone who likes sports memorabilia will be interested in what he's trying to achieve in that corner of the world. But John, before we go to Anthony Farry, obviously I was at the Champions Trophy up in China. Anthony was there, that's why I caught up with him. But it was disappointing in terms of the crowd numbers there.
Terrible.
As a tournament, it was fantastic. And I have to say, if they don't bring the Champions Trophy back, the FIH are mad.
It was a great, both our Champions Trophies, the men's and the women's, the hockey played there was fantastic. The Dutch, what a machine. They just take a couple of parts out, put the replacements in, and they just keep rolling along. They're amazing. Australia, a little bit disappointing, not in the loss to the final, but I thought some of their pool games are a little bit ragged. They managed to turn it off on enough to get to the final. Great Britain, disappointing. China and Japan, very, very promising. Argentina, probably wish they had turned up in the first few days of the tournament.
Well, to be fair, they did turn up. They just couldn't score.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
You have 68% possession and then 73%, and that was the 68 was against the Dutch, and then of course the Netherlands came down, got one penalty corner, scored that home, got another penalty corner, scored that, and then the Argentinian shoulders dropped. But I take my hat off to the way they came back into their coaching staff, because they were at the same hotel as me and they were shattered. Like Delfina Marino, every loss hurts her deeply. I mean, she cared, and she said this to me. She said, you know, there's a responsibility when you wear that shirt for Argentina, because hockey is the number one women's sport there. And he goes, and people look up to us and expect us to achieve. And she takes it very, very personally, which I find really refreshing. I think that I love athletes that care still when they go out and play, even if they, I mean, she's getting close to 300 caps, but she still cares. And that to me is fantastic.
And it's a big tournament. It shows what the tournament meant to them as well.
Yeah. I mean, they'd been in the last 8 finals, so they knew that they couldn't get there this time.
Oh, yeah.
And that hurt. But yeah, GB was a real worry. And again, I think their problem was those who had won the Olympic gold were trying to do too much. And I think they weren't prepared to bring in the younger players, give them the ball, and they were taking too long to make their passes to those players. So I felt sorry, actually, more sorry for the new faces or the newer faces, because I don't think they were given a fair crack of the whip by the senior players.
Oh, harsh criticism, but I think warranted too, having watched them play. I mean, I've thought that England hockey in general, and it's reflected through Great Britain as well, try to do too much. They all think that they're going to win the game off their own stick for some reason, and it's just it's not the game that works that way.
No, well, it's probably a good segue now to go into our first guest, and I've wanted to catch up with him for a while because Anthony Farry is not a name that a lot of Australian hockey fans would be familiar with, because he never ever played for the Kookaburras. But he has, however, carved out a really successful career as a coach, first with Canada and now with Japan, having got Canada to the Olympic Games and also having won the Asian Games for the first time with the Japanese women's team. Anthony Farry, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I really wanted to catch up with you for a long time because I think you've got an interesting story to tell. Now, you're obviously the coach of the Japanese women's hockey team at the moment, but what was your hockey background growing up in Canberra?
I guess, like most people, went through the state system, so played as a junior. I actually got into it through a family friend. His dad was the coach of the team, took me down there to play with his son, and from there on just sort of kept playing because it was good fun. Went through the state system all the way through and then moved into a coaching role. Was sort of tapped on the shoulder by John McKinnon, who's fairly prominent in ACT hockey, and asked to maybe help out with some junior stuff. So was given an opportunity through that to coach some junior stuff. Worked all the way through from 13s, 15s, 17s as it was at that stage before 18s, and then 21s and obviously senior hockey with AHL. So.
So what age were you when you started coaching?
I was pretty young, so I was still playing rep hockey at that stage, maybe early 20s. Yeah, it would have been early 20s when I got into coaching a junior group. And that junior group had guys like Paul McKinnon and Lucas Judge, who's the assistant coach of the Dutch women at the moment. So a lot of these kids coming through I know quite well.
But you've underplayed your playing a little bit because you did play for Australia indoor.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough, I guess, to play the first Indoor World Cup in Leipzig in 2003. Not good enough to play outdoor senior, as a lot of people aren't. It's a pretty prestigious go to play for Australia in outdoor, but had an opportunity with indoor and really enjoyed it. It certainly is a different aspect of the game, and I think it's one that the Europeans utilise quite well, and Australia seeming to do a little bit better in it.
There's a big debate now, isn't there, about whether that actually helps develop your game. Certainly there's players like Flynn Ogilvie who say it definitely does, and there's some of the Germans I've spoken to say they believe it improves your tackling as well, playing indoors. I mean, having played that, do you think it did help your game?
Yeah, without doubt. There's no doubt the close-in stuff, it helps significantly. You know, your control on the ball, your first touch on the ball, you don't get to make mistakes in indoor because you're punished straight away. So I think your ability to control possession is huge. Your one-on-one skill also improves because you have to be better at that side of things. You know, you can't lift the ball. It takes away a whole different dynamic of the game. So I'm a real advocate of it. I think it's a great game, and I think it can be hugely beneficial to transfer in the outdoor.
And there's a lot of people feel that, again, the indoor thing is a way of promoting hockey as well, in that if we took the game inside, as we've seen in Europe, they get massive crowds, great atmosphere, and this is a way to maybe bring in new fans as well.
Yeah, I think if it's marketed in the correct manner and played in the correct way, then it can be a great sport to watch for fans and pretty easy to understand. The nice thing is it's over pretty quickly too, so you're not having people getting too bored. You're generally scoring a lot of goals. It can be a good advertisement, I think.
Going back to your coaching, obviously starting so young while you were still playing, do you think that actually helped you with your coaching? Because suddenly you were maybe paying a little bit more attention to those who were coaching you than you probably would have done before?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, you always take the good and bad out of the coaches that you've seen and you've had. And as a still playing and coaching gives you maybe a bit more thought. It's not an easy thing to do. And it certainly developed me and helped me maybe mature a little quicker than I probably would have had I not been coaching. So, yeah, there were some certainly some positives out of it. I think it's also hard as well. You know, as a player, you think... a little bit differently than you do as a coach. So, yeah, it was a hard transition.
When was it that you thought, actually, I'm really enjoying this and I want to take it as far as I possibly can?
Not until maybe 2008, when I had the opportunity, I think, at that stage to work with Frank Murray and the Hockey Roos. Before that, been focused on business and things that were more of my interest. I had the opportunity to coach and really enjoyed it, but certainly didn't see it as a profession to move into. I think in 2008, 2009, given the opportunity to work with the Hockey Roos, saw a different side of coaching, saw a lot more professional attitudes, I guess, and, you know, working with people that are striving for a common goal is always nice, and it certainly inspired me to maybe take it a bit more seriously and put in a bit more time.
Now, we've had on this show other coaches from around Australia in other sports who didn't represent Australia and or didn't represent even their countries that they came from. And they've said it can be very difficult if you're not a top X player to get ahead in the game, because everyone goes, looks at your CV and goes, well, no, he never played internationally, can't be a good coach. Yet you see Jose Mourinho, Arsene Wenger, Sir Alex Ferguson have all never were outstanding players but have been fantastic coaches. Was it difficult for you to break through?
I think I was in the right place at the right time to get a start. Certainly it wasn't through my ability as a coach. You know, some things are all about timing, and I think I've been reasonably fortunate with my timing in a lot of respects to get to the position I am now. But I also recognise that it's a lot of hard work. Maybe not handed to me like... I guess others in other sports, you know, might be straight out of playing into coaching when you've been at the top level. I have no problem with that. But this certainly is an apprenticeship. You have to serve. Like you, I think it's hard on anyone coaching, but let alone not having the experience to back it up. It's a lot more than just the technical and tactical stuff that you need to be good at. You need to be a good manager of people. And that thing takes time. You know, that's not something that comes naturally to everyone. And certainly the more time you have honing that side of it is better, I think.
You have 5 years in Canada. Was it almost the perfect place to start? Because Canada, with all due respect to their hockey, are not sort of one of the hard hitters, high hitters, top 10 ranking team, but they are a team that can achieve, can trouble the top teams, and it was almost like you could always achieve there and you could get on with your job without anyone really looking at you?
Yeah, I guess to a certain degree. I'm not sure the thought around always achieving was there. We certainly wanted to. I don't think people recognise how much, I'm not going to say sacrifice, but determination of the players and the people in the program to succeed is there. We all complain, like as coaches and administrators, we all complain about we need this, we need that, and, you know, everyone wants more money, they want more time. But I think at the end of the day, the recognition of how much your group is going to put in to be successful is going to tell. And in Canada, we had a group of guys that were firmly focused on a common goal of not only getting to the Olympics, but trying to be successful there. And that really drove them day in, day out. And that makes my job easier. It makes all the staff, their job a lot easier as well. But it doesn't come without challenges.
Now, there were some amazing backstories in your Canadian team, just as there were with the Irish in the Women's World Cup. But do you, that shootout against New Zealand where you qualified for the Olympics in Rio, is that one of the most special memories? Certainly for me as a commentator, it was a phenomenal moment.
Yeah, look, it is special. I think, you know, that in the moment, that's something you always look back on. But the memories I have of that group are going to be the guys running, you know, 400s, 800s around the pitch and just doing that little bit extra, knowing that this could make a difference one day. And I think that's the sort of stuff that I find special. Yeah, the shootout's great, but yeah, that could have gone either way. You know, we all know that these things are a lottery sometimes, and yes, you practice them and you work on them, but, you know, best laid plans often don't come to fruition. But on that day, you know, the stars aligned for us a little bit. We played well enough to keep ourselves in the contest and gave ourselves a shot. And, you know, that's what we often talked about, was making sure that we continually gave ourselves opportunity to win games. So that was really nice. But, you know, I have better memories of the stuff that no one else sees, you know, that I think really builds a culture in a group and builds a cohesiveness within a team.
I know you loved your time in Canada, but the problem was really family, wasn't it? You had young children, wife there, no one really that familial support, and that was really one of the reasons you said to me why you looked to move on. It must be hard for your wife as well to be following a guy, following his dream as a coach.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we do, and if anyone disagrees, they're a liar, is an incredibly selfish profession. You know, we're following our dream, we're following our goals, and we want to do it for the right reasons. You know, you've got the team first, but the partners are always forgotten in this, often. And, you know, full credit to my wife, just an amazing person. I can't believe what she does. Like, to be able to deal with being so far away from home, have no support network at all. You know, we can't lean on our grandparents because they're not there, and friends and family make it harder. But it also galvanises you as a family, I think. Like, we're a lot closer. We do everything together. But I also recognise that, you know, I really want to make sure that Sarah gets something out of life too. Like, she's been following me for a number of years, and the next chapter might be me, you know, working with her around what she wants to attain and her aspirations in life as well. Not that she doesn't love being a mother and looking after the kids, but, you know, I'm aware of her wants and needs too.
How hard was it to convince her to go to Japan?
Not hard at all. Not hard. Sarah's great. She's always supportive of me, and understands that, you know, it's a unique opportunity and something that a lot of people don't do. I mean, a lot of our friends are in Canberra, haven't left Canberra, have stayed in Canberra. Now there's nothing wrong with that. It's, you know, our kids are going to have a different upbringing to a lot of other kids, and a different understanding. I mean, both our kids have Canadian and Australian passports already. This opens a few more doors to them. So, yeah, I think Sarah's really on board, and Japan, being the country it is, it brings challenges. But, you know, she and we as a family have embraced those challenges, and I think we're really trying to make the most of it.
And back to the hockey, how are you enjoying that? Because I know you said to me the language barrier, it's made you a better coach because you've had to be more succinct with your messaging.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to change the view. You have to change your perception of what you think is going to work. And it's also now trying to get on board, 30-plus people that you don't correspond with easily. And going through the translator, so that often is a key area. You've got to make sure that you have someone that really is proficient at that job, but also getting and trying to convey your message in the best way possible. It will never come across perfectly, but certainly I think we're doing a pretty good job of that. The thing I miss most is the one-on-one conversation, you know, not always about hockey, but more so about life and about, you know, the people you're working with on a day-to-day basis often become your family in a certain way. And in Canada I found that, you know, there were guys that I spent a lot of time with talking to outside of hockey about what they wanted to do and things like that. And I can't do that as much here yet, but I feel that we've got a reasonable bond, but, you know, I think the language barrier inhibits that a little bit.
Yeah, something a lot of people wouldn't have considered what you've just said there. But it must have been, if the Olympics was satisfying, I would have thought the Asian Games would have been equally as satisfying, because you managed to galvanise the group to the gold medal, and a lot of people didn't expect Japan to win that.
No, the expectation, I think, was probably on another team or one or other, two other teams, considering the history of what's happened in the Asian Games. We were really disappointed with our World Cup finish. I think that was heartbreak. There was nothing short of heartbreak there. The way we went out was disappointing. Belgium are a great side. We know that. We always knew it was going to be tough, but we expected a little more of ourselves. And, we sat in London, I think it was 2 days before we left, and we talked about how the feeling right now could be completely different in 3.5 weeks' time. And our focus needed to shift from being sorry for ourselves to actually, you know, taking something and using it to our advantage. And I think our performance built all the way through that tournament. And one thing we were able to do was play with a level of consistency that allowed us to win games. And we were obviously, our execution on set piece was really good. And that had a big bearing. Not only were we good defensively on penalty corners, but we were also scoring. And this sort of allowed us to free up the rest of our game a bit and maybe slide under the radar a little. But towards the business end, we almost didn't put a foot wrong. And that was really pleasing. I think for Japan it was huge. I probably didn't recognise the magnitude of how big it was for the country. And, you know, for a lot of reasons, for sponsorship, number one, but just the belief as well for the girls.
Obviously now the excitement must be building for Tokyo 2020. Is there now an expectation that you're going to be on the podium, or is that not there just yet? The Japan a little bit more reserved than maybe the Australian media?
No, there's certainly the expectation within Japan, and I think we've put it on ourselves as well, and I'm probably the key catalyst to that. It's you know, we're going to the Olympics, we're there. Why not us? Like, someone's got to get a gold medal. Why not us? And I think, yes, it's lofty. You know, you see the best teams in the world playing at the moment, and they're doing well. But Ireland have proved, you know, just recently, and Spain, these teams have proved that while the Dutch are out ahead, everyone knows that, there's daylight to second maybe at the moment, but from second anywhere down to 20 is a real contest. And, you know, I think GB proved at the last Olympics, if you're there and you put yourself in a position at the right time, then you get opportunity. And they certainly took that opportunity. So for us, I believe, why not? You know, why can't it be us? And that's the attitude that we've sort of trying to get through the group. And I know day by day when we get better results, you know, so we beat New Zealand in the World Cup, and we win the Asia Games, and we've played okay here, not to our best ability, but we're starting to do okay in patches, and I think every day the girls maybe start to believe a little more, because there's certainly some that don't believe, you know, I'm well aware of that, and why should they, given the history? However, I think as Ireland have proved recently, and we've proved against some good sides, we can win.
Well, Anthony, it's going to be an enjoyable journey over the next couple of years watching Japan and whether they can do it. Congratulations on all you've achieved, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Jacoby from Germany, playing for the Delhi Wave Riders. You're hearing Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to the podcast of Not the Footy Show. And that was Anthony Farrie, the coach of Japan, who, as you heard, hails from Canberra, played indoor hockey for Australia, had a spell working with Frank Murray, but has now had success overseas. And one of the things I wanted to talk to him about, obviously, John, was how hard is it when you're not an ex-international kookaburra to get a job in coaching in this country? Now, we had Spencer Pryor, who obviously played football in the UK. He's not an Australian, but he now calls Australia home. And if you remember, he was saying he had to go overseas to get a coaching gig because he hadn't played for the Socceroos. And there's a lot of good coaches out there that are finding that their pathway in this country. Now, Anthony didn't say that, as we know, but it's much harder for them to get the top jobs or to get the chance of being in amongst the runners for the top jobs because they haven't got that experience. And I think we're maybe missing out on some really talented coaches because of that.
It's interesting because that doesn't seem to be the American experience. If you look through major American sports, there's plenty of managers, coaches, whatever you want to call them, who never played at the top level. And they seem far more ready to embrace a person's intellectual abilities with a game than they do their physical playing attributes. For us, it seems like unless you've got that physical attribute of being that, then you can't do this. You won't understand the players is often something that you hear. But it's patently not true.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at football, Sir Alex Ferguson wasn't a great player. Arsene Wenger wasn't a great player. Gus Hiddink wasn't a great player. But they're all regarded as three superb coaches.
I bet Jose Mourinho thought he was a great player.
Yeah, but again, he wasn't really. I'm sure he wasn't the greatest, but he was next to the greatest, probably. But again, it's like teachers, and you often hear this as well. Now, you've got to clarify this, because obviously, with very talented students, then very intellectual people are often very good teachers for them, because they can kind of spar mentally. But for an average student, often somebody who struggled at school is a better teacher, because they can then understand the problems that that student is facing, trying to comprehend what they're trying to convey.
I spoke to Alison Allen just before the Commonwealth Games as part of the reverse stick, and I asked her about how hard it was. Did you have to temper the way you did things because you were such a good player and it all came so naturally? She said, yeah, that was one of the hardest things she had to do, because everything came, the things that came easy to her didn't necessarily come easily to other people. And it was an important step in her coaching career to step back and understand that about, you know, herself as a coach.
But there's a classic, there was a documentary made about my football team, Swindon Town, before they went in the Premier League. And Dave Mitchell, you know, was the glory coach and played for the Socceroos. He was playing in that team. And there's a clip in that where they're doing a shooting drill. And they're getting it wrong, and Glenn Hoddle goes, guys, it's easy. He goes, and Glenn Hoddle runs through this thing, and he says, you don't even have to look up. You know where the goalkeeper is, and you just bend it round him. And you see Hoddle looking at the ground, and he just curls this ball round the goalkeeper into the bottom corner. And Dave Mitchell goes, but what Glenn Hoddle didn't realise is we weren't all Glenn Hoddle. We couldn't all do that. No. And I mean, but it is exactly what you're saying, is that sometimes players that are that good don't realise that not everyone around them has those capabilities.
And sometimes it's the players who were that prodder who was the last picked, or the second, you know, who is scrapping for the game every week, making good coach, because they understand you need players like that in your team. There's jobs for those sorts of players in every team, in every sport. And when you find them, you can have as many Glenn Hoddles in the world as you like, but how many superstars do you see playing in teams that get flogged all the time? Because you need those blokes that do the real hard things in the background. You know?
Well, yeah, exactly. You need a ball winner to give to the likes of your Hoddles, etc. Yeah. But the other thing that concerns me, and if you look at it across a number of sports, and this is not just in Australia, because I'll give you an example, having spoken to somebody from Germany, and they were saying what they've done is they realised again that they needed more coaching, they had to improve the coaching across all levels of the game. But what they've done is coaching, they've run coaching courses, which they've charged people for, which of course has brought in revenue to the federations in various sports. But now what they've got is a glut of coaches, but they have no way of culling out who's good and who's bad. And I think we've got the same problem here in some sports, like football is a prime example now, where all these people have done FFA courses, they've all come out with C licenses. Some of them wouldn't know how to kick a donkey's ass, let alone a football. And yet, you know, they are now being charging for their coaching abilities. And we're losing people who had genuine coaching talent. And so, to me, if you're going to go down that path of upskilling everybody and giving these qualifications, you've also then got to be assessing them over a certain period of time and saying, you're not up to scratch anymore, sorry, your license is gone.
See, this is where we need a bloke like Richard Nixon, who can call it for what it is, just come out and get rid of the communists from sport. We're communists constantly being told that sport is a business. Well, why are all the models we follow socialist? Why aren't they free market models? And the free market model would say that if you want to coach, you go and coach, because the market will sort out whether you're good or not. But what we have now is a centralised system where people are giving you out bits of paper. That doesn't make you a good coach. Good coach is determined by someone who turns up on a Saturday afternoon, Tuesday and a Thursday night, and runs the drills and does all that sort of stuff, not by a bit of paper. Let the market determine it. Get rid of all of this. You must be this and you must be that. Oh, yeah, of course, have your child cards and all that sort of thing, first aid stuff. Yeah. But as far as a person's ability to coach, let the market determine it.
But that's where, again, I think if you really wanted to go down that path, and I look back at it now and the decisions that were made, and it was what they should have done, in my opinion, is gone into the schools and gone, okay, we need to get A, soccer or football played more in at school level. Then we need to upskill those coaches. We need to make sure we've got the best coaches in the schools so that we're developing these kids at grassroots levels, giving them the skills so they know how to trap a ball, how to pass a ball, how to position themselves on the field of play, etc. And then when they get to the club level, they've at least you've given them the tools to become a good player. And I think that, to me, is what should have been done. And again, if you talk, I remember having a conversation with Terry Walsh, and he said one of the problems as coach of India was, he said, yes, there's hugely talented players in there, but you have these players coming into a national camp and you're having to tell them how to stand to defend a certain ball into the circle. Something that in Australia, he goes, we take for granted that a child at 13 would know that that's his body position, that's where he should stand. In India, they've never been shown it. And he goes, and this is into your national senior squad. You spend a few days doing that before a major tournament. Now, things have obviously improved in recent times for India, otherwise they wouldn't be where they are and challenging at the World Cup. But this is where I think, you know, we've got it wrong. There's coaching and there's coaching, but you need to get the best coaches in the right places, and you need to make sure that they are the best and that they continually achieve. And as you say, and if you're not going to have this natural attrition where if you're no good, you're out the door, then someone has to assess them.
And that's another layer of bureaucracy that enters the whole equation, which is something we don't need or don't
want. Absolutely.
You know, just the circle goes around and around on itself. And look, maybe it's also, you see major teams, they have a head coach, but then they have specialist coaches. And maybe it's about time we started saying, look, as far as being a head coach, but if you want to call yourself a skills coach, then you do have to go through this process. And then, you know, so people aren't feeling they have to do all of the, you know, a game day coach is different from someone taking skill sessions. So maybe that's the way that the model should be looked at.
Absolutely. Well, as I said, we've got two guests on the show. We should probably get on with the next one.
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
Yes, it is indeed Not the Footy Show. Now, a rare situation because we've got two guests on this show. And our next guest, it's only a very short interview because this young gentleman got in touch with me when I was working on the Hockey India League for Star Sports. And I thought what he was trying to achieve was something really unique. And I promised him that I would interview him when I was there for the World Cup. But obviously, I wasn't selected to be one of the commentators for the World Cup. But I thought I would keep my promise and just have him on the show to talk about what he's trying to achieve and set up a museum with players' shirts from various sports. So we're now going to hear from Sampoona Rath. Sampoona Rath, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Well, the Hockey World Cup's about to get underway in Bhubaneswar, but I believe that you've actually are setting up a museum in Bhubaneswar that's really different in that it's going to be a museum of sports shirts. Can you tell us how this idea came about?
This idea came about earlier during 2013-14 during Hockey India League. I started from pieces of player from Australia, Aaron Zalewski. He was playing for my own franchise, Kalinga Lancers. Then I tried to collect jerseys from different players, which later become a motto of mine and to build the museum out here.
So how many shirts do you have now?
I have around 170 plus jerseys of hockey, cricket, football and different sports.
And have you got a venue yet? Because I believe you were going to be sponsored. If you got to a certain number, then someone was going to give you some space where you could exhibit these?
I need to get around more, 120 or so, like minimum 300 jerseys, so that I can get it.
And how difficult has it been getting players to part with their shirts?
It's really difficult to get the jerseys from the player, actually, because many players also often ask them, why you need a jersey of us to get to you? You can misuse the jersey and all, but I make them understand that it's for the collection and it's for my museum and all, so they give me the jersey.
I mean, I presume as well there's that suspicion that you're going to try and sell them?
No. is just my dream is about to build a museum and to see the different people that such I have collected of different pairs.
So what's your goal at the end of this? I mean, how many shirts are you hoping to get, and how do you plan to exhibit them?
My motto is to get to at least 500 jerseys so that I can build out a museum here in Bhubaneswar. And it will be like a museum open for all who can come and see the jerseys which I have collected of different players in different sports, international and national players.
And when you get the museum open, are you going to still continue collecting the shirts so it gets bigger?
Yeah, obviously. I will continue to collect the shirts after the museum also. And at least for museum, we need some years time to make it because it's not the easy thing to do it right now. We need to have certain amount of jerseys, certain amount of money to make sponsors. We can sponsor the museum after that, I guess.
And will people pay to come in the museum, or will it be free of charge?
Yeah, I haven't decided that yet. We'll see that later.
And how are you going to exhibit the shirts? Are you going to have a profile on the player next to the shirt?
Yeah, obviously. I will have the T-shirt in a particular frame of that size, and we'll be hanging on the frame, and we'll also have the profile of the players and the details of the player from which country and his records.
I presume with the World Cup being in Bhubaneswar, you were hoping to have the museum open for the World Cup. Is it disappointing you haven't been able to achieve that?
Yeah. It's really disappointing to not be achieved that because to have the museum, you also need a sponsor to build it and many jerseys to build it. Right now, I don't have 500 jerseys to open it also. I have, if I try, I can make a museum, but also you need some sponsors, so it is difficult right now to open it. Maybe hopefully someday, another time, the World Cup or any event will be there, that time it will be open.
Well, it's a fantastic venture, and I really applaud you because I know how many years you've been trying to put this together, and I really hope it comes together for you in the next couple of years.
Yeah. It's obviously interesting that to come together and need some years.
Well, thanks very much for your time, and enjoy the World Cup while India hosts it.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, I'm Samir Dutt, Olympian hockey player. You're watching on me, not the footy show.
Yes, Samir Dutt, good friend of mine, again, who I worked with on the Hockey India League. And it's good the Hockey India League's coming back, John. Not so sure that it's good it's going to be a five-a-side competition, but very happy that the women are now going to be included. I think that is a real plus.
Yeah, and congratulations to Hockey India for taking that step, because it was one that needed to happen. I think in some ways you could argue that it was forced on them by the success of the women's team recently. And well done to the girls for bringing their side of the sport to national attention.
Yeah, and I will mention at some stage, and I can't remember the two players concerned, but there are two players within that women's team who've been very, very vocal, and they've actually copped a lot of flack in India for actually standing up and saying, we need a Women's Hockey India League. And I hope that those two players are recognised at some point for taking that courageous step and standing up and being counted, and it would be nice if maybe one of the awards was named after them, because I think that in that country, for a woman to stand up and say, we need equality, we need this, and when they're in the national team, which could, in some countries, that could see you dropped, it was incredibly brave, and I take my hat off to
them. And in the highly charged political situation that Indian hockey is, as we've been discussing before we got onto this recording this podcast, that does take some guts.
Well, we mentioned just quickly there, obviously the Hockey World Cup is happening. That was Sampoorna Rath, who's trying to get those 500 shirts to open his museum. So if you know anyone or you want to donate, contact me and I can give you the address to send a shirt for his museum. Obviously he wants a player shirt. He may want a Fremantle one. I mean, double premiership winning John Lee. Triple, sorry,
triple.
I got it wrong. But I was going to mention also the Reverse Stick, which is your podcast with Matt Allen. You're doing daily updates for the Hockey World Cup, so get onto the Reverse Stick for those if you are a hockey fan.
You can get us through all your normal pod catchy thingies. Look out for the links on all the social medias, Instagrams and all that sort of stuff. And join in the party, because we're back by popular demand. We asked the listeners if they wanted us to do it, and they said yes. So
yeah, I voted just because I wanted you to have another sleepless night.
Oh, I tell you what, it's actually a lot harder slog than it sounds. It's like 4 minutes.
I know how hard it is. Exactly. Yeah. No, did really you want to talk about the World Cup briefly?
Well, you can find out all you need to know by listening to the World Cup, darling.
I did just say that.
You can. I'm really looking forward to it. It should be an absolutely ripping tournament. Some of the best athletes in the world going around in one of the most highly skilled games in the world. Just watch. Get onto Fox. If they've got a new Cairo app or something like that, costs you $25 a month. There's a 14-day free trial. So give it a couple of days into the tournament and...
then get your free trial.
Get your free trial. You'll be able to get the final in. The final should be cranking. Odisha, the host city in India, they've really embraced
the
host state.
Bhubaneswar is the city, yeah.
Bhubaneswar. They've totally embraced the competition. There's all sorts of things going around the city. Would have been fantastic to have been there. But thanks to modern technology, we can for game day.
Your tip for the tournament? I mean, I know you had a tipping thing as well on your Twitter page, and I was tagged as to whether I was going to tip, and I opted not to, just because I sort of feel sometimes as a commentator it's best to remain impartial. But I think it's one of the most open tournaments you've had for a number of years, and my four that I think will be there at the end of the tournament for a mix, and I'm going to surprise people with this because one of the teams I'm going to leave out, but I think the four that will be there in the semi-finals will be Australia, Germany, the Netherlands and India. No Belgium for me.
No. You can't tip Belgium because their track record's so poor. You're going into tournaments in red hot form, kicking it real early and then just failing at the big times. And I think until they prove that they can win those big games, you can't include them. Netherlands? They're always going to be hard to beat because their domestic competition is so strong. Same for Australia. We play good, strong, hard domestic hockey, and the Germans do as well. India's going to be there on the back of the home crowd and the fact that there's a lot riding on for them.
And I think also because Harendra Singh is a very good coach. People underestimate that.
Oh, very
He's
good.
Also a great team manager. He's a good player manager. And I think he will manage those players through this tournament. I think the other thing working in his favour is the players like him, and so they will work for him. But I think the thing that was interesting was an interview he gave yesterday before we're recording this podcast, where he said he is not going to curb their natural willingness to attack. And that is part of the Indian game. I think the various European coaches and Australian coaches they've had, they've now shored up their defence. Their defence is a lot better. Srijesh worries me occasionally. I think sometimes he's unorthodox and he lets in the odd weak goal. But I think if Harendra has faith in their attacking abilities, and they've got some wonderful strikers in that squad that he's picked, they can overrun teams and they can concede a goal and score three.
Oh, well, I've said it on the reverse stick that India are the flat track bullies of world hockey. They flog teams that are slightly behind them, but really struggle if someone takes the game to them.
Yeah, I mean, the Champions Trophy in Breda, they completely outplayed Australia in that game. They should have won that. They deserved to win that final. Australia somehow hung on, and Tyler Lovell had an unbelievable game in goal, although Harendra was livid because he goes, look at where we hit the shots. I spoke to him after the game, and he goes, we hit those shots where Tyler Lovell is strong. He goes, if we'd have hit them low down, we'd have probably won it. He goes, but we were hitting them from the knee to the shoulder, and they were easy for him to parry them away. Now, I think, you know, that's the thing is they are good against some of the good teams, but the good teams know how to get under their skin and how to stop them. And there was a little bit of naivety, and maybe, just maybe, that naivety has been pushed to one side a bit now. There's a bit more maturity.
Couple of teams of interest. Argentina, I think they're going to struggle through the tournament.
I think I'll mark my words. They will get frustrated because they're an ageing side and they will suffer because of cards.
Fair enough. That's a good call. I can see France getting through the pool stages and then missing out. Also, teams to note, New Zealand, who've gone under the radar a bit. A few months ago, people were really talking up New Zealand's chances of you know, getting to the quarterfinals the semi-finals of a tournament like this.
Well, those crossover games as well make it wide open as well.
not that they're a true crossover, because you cross over into the same half of your pond.
One bit the FA's got horribly wrong.
Teams that interest me, really, Pakistan. Because if they turn it on, they can beat anybody. They're just so inconsistent, and they've a lot of troubles in Pakistan hockey. But when they play well, and they proved it at the Champions Trophy, when they turn it on, and the Asian
Games
Asian
as well.
Games, yeah, they can be as good as anybody.
And the one thing about Pakistan as well, their defence is pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, it's just their connections moving forward have been maybe a few problems, and goal scoring's been their issue. They haven't had a traditional out-and-out goal scorer, and they'll create, but whether they can convert those opportunities, that's going to be their problem.
And another nation I wasn't thinking too much about until the recent Women's Champions Trophy, China. Because their women's team was markedly improved over what we saw at the World Cup in July. You know, where does the men's team stand in things?
Well, that's a very interesting thing, because you've also got to look at, they didn't send their men's team to the Asian Games, which upset the Asian Hockey Federation. Now, the reason they said they didn't send it was they had no chance of meddling. I don't believe that for a second. I think they just wanted longer in camp, working together. And they were in Changzhou when we got there for the Women's Champions Trophy. Saw them at the hotel, pretty happy bunch, lots of laughs. So yeah, it could be interesting, because again, when they play well, they're a tough team to break down.
If they bring what the women did in the game against the Netherlands at the recent Champions Trophy, then they can take it right up to the best teams. They really press. I don't know if you notice, teams tend to sit back a little bit against the Dutch, waiting for them to come. The Chinese went at the Dutch girls, and they were getting flustered by that. And maybe the men will pick up the same sort of game plan.
Well, we will all know in a couple of weeks, and that's probably when we'll be back with our next podcast.
See ya. We'll be back next week.